Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, we'll learn about a program that aims to keep kids warm during winter months. Jay Fox will speak with the CEO of Directions for Youth and Families about the organization's purpose, history, and services. And more than 190,000 Columbus children under the age of 18 do not have health insurance. Jay will discuss options through Medicaid and CHIP with an expert. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective, here's Jay Fox.
The U.S. Census Bureau reports that almost 18% of Columbus residents live in poverty. That's over 160,000 people. Statistically, families in poverty spend over 80% of their income on essentials like food and housing. Little is left for clothing. Lack of adequate clothing is an issue. It causes emotional distress, leads to truancy, and ostracizes people from their peer group. And the cost of clothing has gone up in recent years, making essentials like coats, shoes, socks difficult to afford. But there is hope through a program called Operation Warm. And Executive Director Grace Sika is with us on Columbus Perspective to talk about the mission and what's happening here in our Columbus community. Welcome, Grace.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here today.
Why are coats and shoes among the most needed items for children in under-resourced areas like the impoverished areas of Columbus and Central Ohio?
You hit so many great points in your introduction. For the children we serve, their families are spending a disproportionate amount of their income on things like food and housing. So for these children, items like a coat or shoes that make the difference on being able to get to school and get out to play often are not the top priority. And when kids have those items and they fit well and they feel good, we see children exhibit more confidence and more hope, which is, of course, a wonderful thing.
So what exactly is Operation Warm and how did it get started?
Operation Warm is a national nonprofit, and we are very focused in what we do. We provide children brand new winter coats, athletic shoes, and socks. And what makes us unique is that we only provide children brand new items that we manufacture because we want to ensure that they receive quality items that will last them through the season or maybe two, that are just like anything you or I would give to our children. For the children we serve, getting something new that fits just right in the color they like has a disproportionately positive impact. We can see it in how they show up every day. Their confidence just zooms.
So beyond the level of the coats, the shoes, and the socks, you guys do more. Talk a little bit about how it expands beyond that.
Our tagline is more than a coat. And the reason for that is we know that for the children we serve, these items are important, but the way that we deliver it to them is equally important and can have an even greater impact. So with partners like Subaru and the 20 retailers across the state of Ohio, we're able to create a program where the community really gets to connect with itself and support itself. And the emotional benefits of that for the children we serve and for all of the adults around them, not only their family members, but everyone who works with those children in a school setting or in a local nonprofit setting, really has a profound impact. It creates a sense of connection. It creates a sense of hope. It creates a sense of confidence. And that's really where the magic is. So when we say we are more than a coat, that's what we're really trying to instill and convey.
Who's spearheading this here in Central Ohio?
We have a fabulous partner with Subaru. Subaru has 630 retailers nationally participating and 20 retailers in Ohio. And each of those retailers has identified a beneficiary near them in their community who they're partnering with to impact those children positively.
So how do the parents of the children in need find out about these resources that could be available to them? And how do they qualify?
Yeah, absolutely. So the way that we work is we work through organizations that identify the children and validate the need. So each retailer, in this example with Subaru, is partnered with a local community-based organization. It could be a school, it could be a Head Start, it could be a government agency or a homeless shelter. You run down the list of any organization that you can envision that works with children every day. Because those organizations are with the children every day, they understand the need of that community and which children and families to serve. So through this system, we're able to really make sure that the children who need the resources are getting them. They're delivered by local helping hands, and we ensure that they are receiving really high-quality products that they'll be proud of.
If I want to volunteer or make a financial donation, how do I go about doing that?
We would love for you to volunteer or make a financial donation. The best way to learn about all of those opportunities is via our website. OperationWarm.org/Subaru is a great place to start because you'll learn a little bit more about this initiative. And from there, you can navigate to volunteer opportunities in your community.
Okay. I want to thank you, Grace, for everything that you do with Operation Warm and the impact that this and our local area Subaru dealerships are having on us in Columbus and Central Ohio so that we have coats, shoes, socks, and more for those who are specifically in need. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
Today we welcome Dwayne Casares. He is the CEO of Directions for Youth and Families to Columbus Perspective. I'm Jay Fox. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Jay.
So Directions for Youth and Families offers programs that provide community-based treatment and prevention services that emphasize commitment to the family, school, and work. And this is an organization, correct me if I'm wrong, that has roots going back to the 19th century?
Yeah, 1899 is actually when the first Florence Crittenden home was opened up as a home for unwed mothers. The name went away from Directions for Youth and Families. We just brought it back when we built the new Crittenden Center and opened that up in November. It's been a collection of an awful lot of mergers, friends and family, one-to-one, short-stop teen drop-in center, and now we're just the collective Directions for Youth and Families.
So when you think about what characterizes your agency in the mind of the public, what do you think the first thing that someone would say when asked, have you heard of Directions for Youth and Families?
Yeah, I think one of our most unique things is all of our services are outreach. So we serve over 7,000 kids in the Columbus area, and we all do this in the community. So we have licensed social workers and counselors and therapists who actually go into the home to provide our services. We don't want transportation or child care to ever be a barrier to good mental health treatment. The second part is that all of our services are free. So I think those two things are huge. But really, for all the people that we serve, all the kids and families that need the support.
So there's a wide variety of services that you offer in that regard. You mentioned mental health. Is that both assessment and counseling?
Yep. We start every treatment process with the full biopsychosocial diagnostic assessment. We make a diagnosis and develop the treatment plan from there that's individualized to each person's situation, and then we move forward from there. So that's in our treatment programs. Some of our trauma programs are geared towards something a little bit different. So Promises is for survivors of sexual abuse, COMS is children of murdered parents and siblings. Our VOCA program deals with situations of domestic violence. So all of those also have a group component to it, as well as a family counseling component to it. So depending on the presenting problems, we change up the services to address it accordingly.
Do you have an affiliation with a psychiatric hospital or treatment facility when folks need inpatient care?
No, we do not. Our intake, if that gets to that point, we try to do everything we can to prevent it. We're not truly equipped to deal with like schizophrenia and things like that. So these are things that we will send elsewhere, typically to the community mental health centers. We do more traditional things along lines of ADHD, anxiety, depression, mood disorders, and then all the specialty trauma programs.
Sexual abuse survival is a very difficult subject to tackle. We did a story today specifically about a sexual abuse investigator, a nurse that actually exists now with University Hospitals up in Cleveland. To what degree do you deep dive into those issues?
All the way. It's a, you know, it's interesting. In our Promises program, almost probably half the referrals in our Promises program did not enter our agency because of sexual abuse. It has typically been another behavior. And then as we develop the therapeutic relationship, we end up finding out, or they end up disclosing once they feel a safe environment and trust, that all of this does stem from untreated trauma of sexual abuse. So it's that is an individual, family, and group program. I'll tell you a unique thing that happened with the group program, and this probably happened maybe 10 years ago, and it's a component of our program now. We always have a celebration at the end of group. So all the kids, you know, when they first go to group, even though they know they're going to be with other people who experience the same thing, it's terrifying. But then once they start working as a collective together through their healing process, at the end we have a celebration. And it's probably 10 years ago that the group, and we're talking about kids that are average about 7 or 8 years old, they were talking about how their first group was compared to their final group, and how frightening it was in the beginning, and how much they are, you know, really united in the end and helped each other in their healing. And they wanted to end up asking, would it be possible for us to write letters to the next group to let them know it's going to be okay? Which was stunning. You know, I always tell our workers, we all got our bachelor's, master's, and PhDs. We think we're so smart. And it was these kids who came up with one of the most greatest parts of this program. And we still do that to this day.
Peer-to-peer support is extremely important. And we talked about sexual abuse. At some point in time, the sexual abuse survivor may end up in a situation where they find themselves having problems later in life, even if that abuse has happened earlier in their life. To
yes.
What degree does that impact your teen parenting classes?
You know, there are so many different things that come up during the process. So it's not just sexual abuse. It can be many other untreated trauma issues. And we just have to address it as it comes. I don't know that it's real prevalent in our teen parenting program any more than it is any of our other programs. So we deal with it as it comes.
Well, and not everything that you do involves trauma. For example, kindergarten readiness and traditional parenting classes are two examples of things that are necessary but may not have that negative component to it.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. We have a whole slew of educational programs. So we have treatment, education, and then we actually have two after-school centers as well.
When we talk about life for kids who are having problems, that line of demarcation of the age of 18 seems to be a pervasive problem in every county in the state. What do you do for folks that are over 18 but perhaps under 25 that may still need that kind of help?
Yeah, well, we got rid of that 18 line, whatever that is, a long time ago. We actually serve adults as well. It's just the majority of the people we serve are kids. So it doesn't matter to us what the age is. Actually, when we look at some of our programs that are serving that we call youth programs, we kind of extended that to 24 anyway. I don't know who decided these lines. They make no sense in treatment, so we ignore them.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Do you teach these individuals how to be ready for independent life? For example, how to balance a checkbook, how to pay your bills, how to cook a simple meal, how to do laundry. Is any of that a part of what you offer?
Yeah, that's not necessarily in our treatment programs, but it is a big part of our after-school programs. We are actually looking at launching a couple other things that are going to start moving a lot of our kids who may not be ready for college into trades, and using virtual stuff to actually see what their interest is and explore those things. We have a partnership with Delta Bank that we are going to start bringing in financial literacy classes. These are all things that are just critical life skills that the kids that we serve need.
We've been talking with Duane Casares, who is the CEO of Directions for Youth and Families here in Central Ohio. And would you like to give a website if they'd like more information?
You can check us out at dfyf.org, or you can put in Directions for Youth on YouTube. We have many videos about the services that we provide.
Great. Duane, thanks for speaking with us today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
21% of Columbus residents are under the age of 18. That's almost 191,000 kids. And many do not have health insurance. When children have access to routine medical care, they're less likely to miss school. They're able to participate in extracurricular activities and more likely to complete high school and graduate college. As we're now in school mode again, parents, guardians, and caregivers may be able to qualify for free or low-cost health coverage through Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program. Kate Guinness is the Senior Policy Advisor for Medicare and Medicaid as it pertains to children's health. And Kate, for those who don't know or may not remember, what are Medicaid and CHIP programs and what's covered under these services?
Thanks, Jay. Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program, which I'll refer to as CHIP, offer free or low-cost health coverage for eligible children, teens, and adults. And it covers really a wide range of services, including well child visits, vision care, dental care, immunizations, really all the things that kids need to keep them healthy.
So how do we know who is eligible for these programs? Is it based on income, and what's the threshold?
It is based on income. Each state has Medicaid and CHIP programs that have some differing eligibility, but you can go to find coverage for your family on insurekidsnow.gov for specific enrollment information in Ohio, and you can click on your state. And eligibility generally depends on how many kids are in the family or how many people are in the household. And in most states, children up to age 19 with family income up to $80,000 a year for a family of four may qualify for Medicaid and CHIP.
So why do we feel it is so important for students to have this coverage, other than the things that we mentioned earlier? But why is this urgent right now?
Sure. So we want to make sure that kids stay healthy, because healthy kids are ready to learn, and having coverage can improve kids' academic performance, their long-term health, and their future economic success. And really, health coverage for kids benefits everyone. So kids are less likely to miss school due to illness, and really they're going to be less dependent on parents staying home from work if they can get to school. So it also allows kids to stay involved with their after-school activities, clubs, and sports. So we really want to make sure that kids get the coverage and care that they need.
When we talk about the specific services that are particularly important for students, what would you say the number one thing is that students need to pay attention to in their own personal health?
Well, I would say two things, Jay. First of all, I think well child visits, so really those annual physicals, for the littles, it's more than annual, but for most kids, it's once a year. In addition, we know that kids really need a lot of mental and behavioral health services these days. Kids can struggle, and they can get those services covered. Those are covered through Medicaid and CHIP. And we want to make sure that kids can get those services when they need them. And in particular, things like anxiety disorders, depression, and attention issues can impact kids' learning. So we want to make sure that they get the services that they need and that are available under Medicaid and CHIP.
It may or may not come as a shock to those who are listening to this program right now, but drug and alcohol services are also important for students. Is that part of the program?
That is part, and thank you for raising that, Jay, because that is part of the broader mental and behavioral health services that are covered, and there are a range of services, including ones that you could get at your pediatrician's office all the way to emergency rooms or hospitalizations if someone were to need that, which we hope that kids don't need.
Is there a window that people have to register for this, or is it open enrollment at any time?
Medicaid and CHIP have open enrollment at any time, and you can visit insurekidsnow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW to get the information about the programs in Ohio. And you can walk in, there are online applications, phone applications. So really, we want to make sure that whatever is easiest for families to get coverage for their kids, they can use that means of getting access.
Now, once they have the coverage, do the parents have to reapply every year? How do we keep this going?
I'm glad that you asked that question. So, for the most part, kids do need to be renewed every year. A lot of times, kids will be renewed automatically, and so parents should keep an eye on the mail, and they might see a form that says, you're all set, or they might see a form that says, please respond because we need more information. I encourage folks to please respond if they need to. The other thing that is important is if you have moved, we know people switch addresses if you have moved, make sure that your Medicaid and CHIP office knows that you've moved and has your most up-to-date address so that they can find you when they need to.
The old comedy routine says, on the day you turn 18, your bags will be waiting for you at the front door and welcome to adulthood. But for so many people, that critical time period between the ages of 19 and 24, when they may or may not still be considered, quote unquote, a student, is a period of instability. What programs are available for people who are in that 19 to 24 gray zone?
So the Medicaid and CHIP programs actually go up to age 19, and so kids would continue to be covered until that age. And if you need to find additional coverage, you can go to insurekidsnow.gov and click on it, and it will help you find the portal for young adults as well as for kids. So that's probably a good one-stop that anybody could go. There is an insurance marketplace as well that they may be able to get coverage through. If they need help paying for it, they might be able to get help paying for it. So I would encourage young adults, probably with their parents' support if they have it, to go there and try to find coverage through the marketplace if they need.
So for the 191,000 kids in Columbus that do not have health insurance, hopefully this has provided some hope and some value for you. We want to thank Kate Guinness for being our guest today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
Sweeping legislation now signed into law. Ahead on Face the State, the new law creating controversy in the classroom as another carries bipartisan support aimed at protecting Ohio children. We're sitting down with Ohio House Minority Leader Allison Russo. Coming up, she's weighing in on some of the big issues that just became law and her focus for the year ahead. With the new year, a new Ohio General Assembly is underway. The first day of a new legislature is a day of pomp and circumstance. Representatives and senators were sworn into office. Democratic and Republican leaders also officially took their posts as elected by their colleagues. As state lawmakers are drafting new legislation, Governor Mike DeWine finished up last year's work by signing the remaining passed bills into law. Just on Wednesday, he signed more than two dozen new laws. That includes the controversial House Bill 8, also known as the Parents' Bill of Rights. Under the new law, school officials must notify parents if their child asks to be identified by a different gender. It also requires public schools to tell parents about sexuality content materials they plan to teach. And this will give parents the option to request other instruction.
If you're a parent, you want to be informed what's going on in your child's life. That the parents are the best teachers. They're the first teachers. They're the best teachers. It's very, very important.
Opponents of the new law say it puts LGBTQ plus students' health and safety at risk by requiring teachers to out them to their parents. The law also requires school districts to allow students to leave campus for religious instruction during the school day. The law goes into effect April 8th. Another new controversial policy signed into law allows police agencies to charge up to $75 per hour for body camera video. The cost caps at $750. Critics of the new law say it will make it harder to hold police accountable and provide transparency to the community. DeWine says this law will remove the, quote, unfunded burdens on these agencies. Another new law is aimed at protecting Ohio children. Surrounded by the family and friends of Braden Marcus, Governor Mike DeWine signed Braden's Law. It makes sextortion a felony in the state. Braden was a student at Olentangy High School who took his own life 3 years ago after becoming a victim of financial sextortion. The new law mandates cell phone companies give parents access to a child's phone within 30 days of a child's death. It also increases penalties of sextortion from a third degree to a second degree felony if a person dies through the act of sextortion. And it makes the crime a first degree felony if that person is a minor, elderly, or disabled. Braden's mother spoke to 10TV's Angela Ann at the bill signing.
3.5 years. The journey for you. Where are you in that journey today?
Not quite sure yet. Haven't had time to sit down and think about it. It's just day by day in our house, so we just get up and keep on going. We got little Miss Ella that we have to keep afloat, and us as a family just keep on trucking. That's all we can do.
One part of the law that was removed before it passed would have added victim compensation. That is something lawmakers tell us is a focus as they begin this new General Assembly. The governor also celebrated the signing of Madeline's Law. The sponsors say it will provide Ohio children and young adults with the right to hear. It mandates that insurance companies cover the cost of hearing aids for thousands of Ohioans under the age of 22 who don't have it today. One of the people in that group that you just saw there is my guest today, House Minority Leader, Allison Russo of Upper Arlington. She was a primary sponsor of the Madeline's Law bill. Leader, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Doug. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. That bill was a long time in coming. You've been working on that for like 6 years or so, right? And how did it feel to finally see it become law?
Yeah, well, first of all, we started working, both now Senator Weinstein, Casey Weinstein from the Akron area, and myself, our freshman term. So way back in 2019, we were both approached by families within our individual districts, and we wrote the legislation, introduced it. It's had a long road. Ohio will become the 26th state to require insurance coverage for hearing aids for children and the related services. This is a great example of legislation that does real good for families and will have huge impact, but also originates from the people in our communities and those who need help making progress.
Now, on the other side, in another issue, you did not support the Parents' Bill of Rights that we talked about here just a couple seconds ago. What are your concerns about it now that it's signed into law?
Yeah, well, I think in its original concept, had no issue with the legislation. As it went through the process, there were some very concerning amendments added to it. One was this piece that essentially requires mandatory outing of students who could be in a very vulnerable position it's very vague in how, you know, counselors, for example, social workers, teachers might navigate that if the child might potentially receive harm if that information is released. And also concerning to me and others was the requirement that school districts do release time for religious instruction in the middle of the day. Prior to this, the law was it was up to the local school districts and local communities to make those decisions that were best for those districts and with parent and local input. This takes that away. It is a one-size-fits-all. It's Columbus telling every community how it should be done, and we oppose that.
The first part of it that you were talking about, but don't parents have the right to know, you know, what's going
sure.
on in their children's
Absolutely.
Lives?
Absolutely. And by and large, I myself have three children in school right now. By and large, lots of information communicated about what is being taught in the classroom, what books are being read, et cetera. The piece that was concerning to us is if there's a situation where a child might be endangered by the information that is released to the parents, including, for example, their questioning their sexuality, it is vague in terms of what are the responsibility of those people, counselors, guidance counselors, or social workers, et cetera, in mandating that that information be released.
Looking forward now, what is the Democratic caucus's, you know, chief, like, priority heading into this brand new General Assembly?
Yeah, well, I think we are going to continue to be very focused in some of those economic issues and how do we reduce cost for everyday Ohioans. So a lot of the issues that we've been fighting for and working on in this previous General Assembly and, frankly, for General Assemblies before this, you'll hear us and continue to talk a lot about how do we provide direct relief and reduce property taxes in our communities. That is something that we know what needs to be done. It's getting the political will to make it happen and get that relief to homeowners. Also, you know, you'll hear us talking about reducing costs, for example, of childcare and, you know, making sure that people can afford to have their young ones taken care of well while they're getting back into the workforce.
And there's legislation that, of course, you know, was being worked on in the previous General Assembly. That would have to start over now. Are you expecting similar or the same bills basically to be reintroduced?
Yeah, I mean, we had a package and some of it was bipartisan, a package of multiple pieces of legislation, particularly in this reducing property taxes and providing direct relief to homeowners. And, you know, you'll see us pushing that again and talking about that again, whether it be standalone legislation or perhaps pieces that we work into the upcoming state operating budget.
And one of the big issues, of course, was the legalization of recreational marijuana here. The House and Senate were at odds, didn't come up with any real agreements to put into law coming out of the last General Assembly. Is that still being worked on as we speak and trying to figure out what those guardrails are?
Well, certainly the new House Speaker, Speaker Huffman, has expressed a desire to change part of the law, pieces of the law that was passed by Ohioans about 18 months ago. I mean, listen, my stance, and not just my stance, there are many Democrats and Republicans who feel this way, is we have to maintain the will of the voters and what the voters passed a year and a half ago. And we want to make sure that the communities that have made the decision to allow growing, processing, dispensing, that they are able to get the economic benefit from making those decisions. It shouldn't be coming back to the state and for the state making the decisions of where that revenue should go. Do I think that there are some guardrails and opportunities, for example, and making sure that minors don't have easy access
like
to the product
or
the Delta 8 products? Yes, absolutely. You know, I think that there's a lot of common ground that we can find there and things that we need to address that the law did not address. Mm-hmm. But if we're talking about wholesale changes and what is available to adults, where the revenue is going and coming back to local communities, we are going to remain remain opposed to that.
Now, I have to ask you, of course, there's a lot of focus right now on Governor DeWine making a decision on who will replace Senator J.D. Vance in the Senate. So on the political side of it, there's also the race for governor that people are talking about. Last week, as you know, former Ohio Health Department Director Dr. Amy Acton announced that she is running for governor in 2026 as a Democrat. And Attorney General Dave Yost has said he will be a candidate on the Republican side. You know, as leader, I just have to ask you, are you considering a run for governor? Is that even on your mind at this time?
So listen, it is very early in the election cycle before 2026. I think we're going to see probably a number of candidates step up on both sides, Republicans and Democrats. I anticipate there will be very healthy primaries on both sides. In terms of what my decision is, you know, I don't know what is next yet. I am looking at all potential options. But what I do know is that I am very focused on getting through this General Assembly. We've got a transportation budget coming up in the next few months. We've got a state operating budget, which is the largest policy document in the state in the next 6 months. So I am very focused on the job at hand, and there's a lot of work to be done. And, you know, I'll worry about what's in the future later.
I think you just answered my next question, was that, you know, what are you going to be specifically focused on, but you handled it already. Leader Russo, thank you so much for your time today. I really do appreciate it, and I look forward to seeing what's coming out of this next General Assembly.
Thank you, Doug.
Thank you.
President Biden says he will be in attendance for the inauguration of Donald Trump.
Of course I am. Only president ever to avoid an inauguration was the guy that's about to be inaugurated.
But that claim is false. Four other past presidents skipped out on the inauguration of their successors, according to researchers from the White House Historical Association and the Library of Congress. John Adams was absent for Thomas Jefferson's swearing-in. It was the first time in American history power was handed over to the opposing party, and Adams wanted to avoid any conflict. John Quincy Adams and Andrew Johnson also boycotted their successors' inaugurations. Both had deep personal dislike for the men who came after them. And Martin Van Buren wasn't there for William Henry Harrison's famously long address, possibly because his son was sick at the time. In 2021, Trump was the first president since 1869 to opt out of the ceremony.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
We have received several questions about firefighters traveling to California to assist with wildfires being delayed or turned away. Verify viewers Deanne and Carol asked us to look into claims that fire trucks sent from out of state were being turned away because they didn't pass emissions tests.
Did you hear that California rejected 60 fire trucks that Oregon had sent over to fight out the Los Angeles fire?
So let's verify. Our sources are CAL FIRE and the Oregon State Fire Marshal. The Oregon State Fire Marshal poured cold water on this rumor on social media, saying, to be clear, this is false, adding there was no drama, no delays, and definitely no emissions test roadblocks when they got to California. CAL FIRE also addressed these rumors on social media, saying no emissions or smog testing was performed, and no vehicles from out of state have been turned around or refused. So, what actually happened? According to CAL FIRE, each truck did have to go through a 15-minute safety inspection upon arrival in California, noting that these trucks don't regularly travel hundreds of miles at a time, and that firefighter safety is their number one priority. So we can verify, no, California did not reject or delay fire trucks coming from out of state because of emissions tests. With your Verify, I'm Ariande Till.
On January 6th, Louisiana health officials reported the first death from bird flu in America. Some people online are wondering if there's a bird flu vaccine. So let's verify. Our sources are the FDA, the CDC, and the American Academy of Pediatrics. The FDA approved bird flu vaccines in 2007, 2013, and 2020. But the American Academy of Pediatrics says those vaccines are outdated because the virus is always mutating, just like the seasonal flu virus. The CDC says it's prepared to mass produce a vaccine for the current strain of bird flu, but that won't happen until health officials think it's necessary. and the current strain of bird flu can't spread from one human to another. Scientists say the virus would have to significantly mutate for that to happen. Right now, it's only spreading to people who have had close contact with infected animals. So we can verify, yes, there is a bird flu vaccine, but it's not currently available. If that mutation does happen, and it might not, health officials say they're ready to make millions of vaccines tailored to the relevant strain. With your Verify, I'm Casey Decker.
You have plenty of time, but before we know it, tax season will be upon us. And if you want to file your taxes for free, the IRS may be able to help you out. The Internal Revenue Service's free file tax software is now available. Millions of eligible taxpayers will be able to take advantage of the program by accessing the vendor sites through links at irs.gov. But the program only works for people who made less than $84,000 in adjusted gross income in 2024.
Again, that's Doug Petcash, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.